which son is actually doing the Father's will? Jesus asks. The son who says that he won't do it, then does? Or the son who says that he will do it, then does not? Clearly the first. But what's Jesus getting at here? The truth is, he's making two points. The first point is about authority. His authority. This is how the conversation began, after all, with the Pharisees challenging Jesus to tell them by what authority he does the things he does. Jesus is, in effect, saying, "You want to know the source of my authority? Go back and check and see what exactly it is that God tells us to do. Once you do that, you'll see that that's precisely what I'm doing. I do the Father's will. That's the basis of my authority." At the same time, though, Jesus is also making a second point, one about identity. In this case, our identity. Our identity as his followers. He wants to make it absolutely clear what it really means to follow him. He's saying that it's not enough simply to claim to be his follower. You have to actually show that you are. And you do that by doing what he says to do. Serve others, help others, love others. As Jesus says in Luke 6:4-46, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I tell you to?" In fact, given a choice between living out his teaching, between saying that you follow Jesus but not living out his teaching, or simply living out his teaching, it is the second that Jesus prefers. As Jesus says in Matthew 7, verses 21 through 23, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but those who do the will of my Father." This is a powerful challenge to us. It's meant to be. It's a challenge to us, first of all, to truly live out the gospel by reaching out to those most in need, as Jesus did, people we might not normally meet, in order to help them, to honor them, to cherish them. It is also a challenge of another sort, though. It's a challenge to us to recognize that all those who serve others in this way are doing God's will, and so are among those who Jesus recognizes as his own. This last point became clear to me many years ago. I mentioned last week that I spent a year in Japan. What I didn't say was that it was my last year in college. I spent the year studying at the International Division of Waseda University in Tokyo. While there, I lived with a family. The father of the family was an executive at Honda and seldom home. There were two grown children, both daughters. One lived abroad. I never met her. The other, Kazuko, was married to an Englishman and spoke English very well. But although she also lived in Tokyo, I didn't see her often either. That meant that I spent most of my time with the mother of the family. I called her Oka-san. Oka-san is what small children call their mother. The best translation is probably mommy. That term provides a pretty good description of her relationship to me, too. For one thing, Oka-san spoke no English at all. That meant that we were entirely dependent on my Japanese. I had studied the language for 2 years, but I never got very good at it. So I came to rely on Okasan to explain things to me, much the way a child relies on his mother. As a result, I found myself talking to Okasan for hours every day. I'd talk to her over breakfast, then again over dinner, which she and I almost always had alone together. More often than not, then, I'd also sit with her until about 10 in the evening, which was when her husband usually came home from work. We'd watch TV together while she explained to me in simplified Japanese what was happening on the programs we were watching. As the year passed, Okasan and I grew very close. I learned so much from her. I also learned a great deal about her. I learned that she had had a son, for one thing, her firstborn. I learned that he had died when he was 5 years old, and that this remained a great grief to her. I learned that I was the 10th American student to live with her in the past 10 years. And I quickly guessed that she had cared for all of them with the same gentleness and dedication that she was caring for me. I also learned that she was a devout Buddhist. Okasan made this last apparent in many ways, but it particularly hit home on one occasion. More and more as our year together was coming to an end, she began to ask me to write to her when I returned to America. I'd always say I would. "Oh, you American students always say that," she answered, "but you never do." "Well, I will," I said. "I'll write, I promise." She'd nod, but her expression remained skeptical. She kept bringing it up. So once I joked with her, "You're not going to want my letters, Okasan," I said. "My Japanese is awful. I write like a child. I'll probably soon forget my Japanese anyway. Then what am I going to do?" "Doesn't matter," she says. "If you can't write in Japanese, write in English. I don't have to be able to read it. Just write." I gazed at her, puzzled. "You don't have to be able to read it?" I asked. "I don't understand." With this, Okasan took a deep breath and looked away. "Okay," she said at last. "I probably should tell you that I want the letters for a reason. I want to collect the letters that I get from you and from all my American students and tie them together in a bundle. Then, when I die, I want the priest to burn them at my funeral. The smoke from those letters will be my prayers to the Buddha to examine my life, to see how I lived. Maybe I will find a place in heaven. I pray that I do." I didn't say anything, but I have to admit that at the time, all this seemed rather bizarre to me. At that point in my life, I had completely rejected my Christian upbringing. I considered myself a thorough agnostic. Not long afterwards, though, something occurred that gave me an entirely new perspective. What happened was this. I walked into the house one afternoon, only to find myself suddenly in the midst of an argument. It was between Okasan and her oldest daughter, Kazuko, the one who spoke English. I say argument, but it was actually Kazuko who was doing all the talking. She was clearly very upset with her mother. I turned away at once, hoping to quietly exit when Kazuko called me back. "You might as well stay," she said in English. "This involves you too, at least indirectly. My mother's signed up to have another American student here after you leave," she said. It will be her 11th student in 11 years. And it's crazy. She gives her whole life to it. She completely wears herself out taking care of all of you. And you know why? Has she ever told you that she had a child before I was born, a boy? Yes, I said. She told me that he died when he was 5. Well, let me tell you, Kazuko said, he didn't just die. He was killed. It was during the war. He was at school, and the school was bombed by American bombers. Kazuko gestured towards your mother. She's never gotten over it. Having you and all the other American students like you, that's her way to try to deal with it. The only thing is, it never lets her forget it. It just has to stop. I looked at Okasa. She had turned her back to me. She covered her eyes. Is it true? I asked her quietly in Japanese. Was your son killed by American bombs? Still without looking at me, she waved her hand in the air as if to dismiss the whole idea. It was long before you were born, she said. When she finally turned to me again, her face was distraught. It was several moments before she could speak. I just keep thinking, she said at last. I just keep thinking that people who know each other's children can't be enemies. If the men in that airplane had known my son, they wouldn't have dropped that bomb. I believe that. But they didn't know him. So I decided to get to know their children instead. Then maybe there wouldn't be enemies anymore. When I returned to America, I had every intention of writing to Okasan just as she had asked me to. But one thing always led to another. And before I knew it, years had gone by and I still hadn't written even one. I often thought of her, though. I often thought of this woman who had resolved to get to know the children of those who had killed her child, and in the process had become practically a second mother to me. And when I finally decided to return to Christianity, the example of this loving Buddhist woman was part of the reason I did so. Back then, I would sometimes ask myself, who really is the better Christian here? Me, who claims to be one? Or that quiet, gentle woman who knew nothing of Christianity and yet devoted her life to loving with a mother's love the children of countrymen who had killed her son? Even as I posed the question, I knew the answer. What I had experienced from Okasan felt to me like nothing less than Jesus' love. Eventually, I wrote a book about the Christianity that had become so important to me. It had been in the bookstores for several years when suddenly I had an idea. I dug up Okasan's address and sent her a copy of my book. Along with it, I sent a short note written in English. I knew her daughter would translate for her. Dear Okasan, the note said, after all this time, I'm finally writing to you my first letter. I'm very sorry I let you down, but I think of you often. Now I've written this book, and I'd like you to have it. No need to try to read it. Please burn it. In place of the letters I didn't write but wanted to, the book has 192 pages. Please know that the smoke of every single one of those 192 pages will drift to heaven, filled with my love and gratitude for all that you have done for me. Not that you need them. You touched my life and changed it. And if these pages can add a little to all the praise that you deserve, then that alone was reason enough to write the book. Love, Ernie. 3 months later, I got a letter back from Okaz-san. It was 6 pages of tiny Japanese script. By then, what little I knew of the language had entirely evaporated. I took the letter to my sister. She had also studied Japanese and knew it far better than I, but even she had forgotten much of it. She stared at the letter for 10 minutes or so, turning over one page, then another. "I can't make out most of it," she said. "I can tell you that she's very, very grateful for the book, though. But there's a part here that doesn't make sense to me. It looks like she says that she's going to burn the book." "Oh, that's wonderful," I said. My sister turned and gazed at me quizzically. "So you get this reaction from readers a lot, do you?" she asked. "No," I said, "not a lot, just this one. But it's probably the best response I've ever gotten." A few years ago, I got word that Okaz-san had passed away. I never learned whether my book, or for that matter, any of the letters of the students wrote that who she had cared for had been burned at her funeral. I hope so. In the end, it doesn't matter, though. Her life speaks for itself. So now let me ask you, what do you think? Do you believe God heard those prayers? The prayers Okaz-san offered through the letters? The prayers she offered through her life? The prayers to her higher power to welcome her into heaven? Do you? Or do you think not? I'll tell you my opinion. It's an opinion based in part on today's reading and in part on my own experience of God's mercy. I believe, first, that when my time comes to enter eternity, there will be a great crowd of people there to greet me. Among the crowd will be family and friends. There will be those I know and those I don't know. There will be dear ones who have gone before and ancestors who I have never met. I believe, second, though, that somewhere among that crowd, probably standing towards the back, patiently waiting her turn, Okaz-san, too, will be waiting. I was a foreigner, and she welcomed me. I was different from her, and she honored me. I was the child of her enemies, and she loved me, hoping with her love to end hatred forever. I simply can't believe that, in God's great mercy, God would do anything less than welcome her, honor her, and love her in return. That's my opinion. Now it's your turn. What do you believe?